Yeah, I'm curious to when the moment was that you, that things really shifted to where you realized like, this could be my future, or that, you know, this could be my career. Like, mm-hmm. this is kind of where it shifted from, you know, a hobby or maybe even a job that was making a little bit of money to where like, okay, I can, this can grow into a career.
Yeah, it was at those markets and hearing customer testimonials and people really excited about my product, returning every week, asking me what stores they could find my products in. And that's when, right, I realized, I can start selling wholesale. I can build out a real website. And then from there, it all took off.
Welcome to the Small Business Storytellers, the show where we dive deep into the stories and secrets of businesses focused on not just making money, but making the world a better place. My name is Seth Silvers, and my passion is helping businesses grow that are making the world a better place. Every episode, you will hear from transformational leaders and business owners as we dive into what has helped them grow and what has helped them stay true to themselves along the way. Also, every week we are hosting live conversations with our guests on Fireside Chat, where we give you, the audience, the opportunity to ask them your burning questions. So make sure to join us live on Fireside Chat on your mobile device. Let's dive in.
Hello, 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 everybody. Welcome to the Small Business Storytellers. Fireside, or the show, then the focus of this show is bringing to you the best stories that you maybe have never heard. And so we do that by bringing you real stories of small business owners and sharing with you, yes, how it's been done, but also really sharing with you the passion, the purpose, the cause behind their stories. So today's going to be great because we have the one and only Schmidt on the show with us. Jamie, how are you doing this morning?
Hey, Seth. Great. Excited to be here.
Good. Wonderful. Where in the world are you?
I am currently just outside of San Diego. Just moved here actually a few weeks ago from Portland, Oregon.
Cool. Awesome. We're actually in Hawaii this week. We've been wanting to come for years and we finally made it out. So there's wild roosters everywhere in Hawaii. So if you hear some roosters in the background, then that's why.
Could be worse.
Yeah, I know. It's a great time of year to be out here. So, Jamie, I'm really excited for this interview and excited to get to hear your story. I've been diving into your book, Supermaker, for the last like week. And it's fun. It's been a while since I've read a book that the way it's written and the pictures and everything is fun. And so for any listeners that just like have a good time during this interview, I encourage you, buy her book, Supermaker. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're in the maker industry, definitely do that. But for our listeners, that don't know you or are not familiar with your story, can you kind of just start out by just giving us a brief bio of, you know, who you are and what you do, and then we'll kind of dive, we'll kind of rewind and go back into your story a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm the founder of the brand Schmidt's Naturals. As Seth stated, it's a maker born brand. I started it in my kitchen back in 2010, more as a hobby than anything else. I hadn't quite realized the business potential when I was building until I started getting out at the farmers markets around Portland and hearing customer enthusiasm, and then quickly understanding, there actually is business potential in what I'm building here. And so we're most known for our deodorant product. Natural deodorant back then was kind of few and far between, and the options that existed on the market just kind of didn't work well. There was a shared frustration amongst consumers. We had a few brands, you know, Tons of Maine and Jason, that we're sort of the pioneers in that space, but there was certainly opportunity to do more. So I recognized that, and not just in, you know, the formula and the effectiveness, but also in the branding and just the way, you know, the product was marketed back then. You know, this was 2010 and naturals were still more catered to the niche customer. You know, I wanted to change that, and I saw opportunity to reach the masses, and, you know, it took a lot of education and some convincing and, you know, a product that performed well. But, 7 years later, Unilever came knocking and we were acquired. And so I guess it's fair to say we, you know, had reached the masses at that point.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, our friends that we're staying with here in Hawaii, I mentioned that we're doing this interview, and our friend Amy was like, oh Yeah, I love their deodorant. I know them. So it's cool to even just see how widespread it's become. And this is a fun interview because, you know, I'm sure there's more that you want to do in your career in business. And so we'll dive into that. But most businesses are aspiring, you know, to acquire it. And so this will be a fun interview because we'll get to talk about a little bit of, you know, just what was that like and what's it like kind of after that story. And I think the story is so good. It's like you started it, you know, in your kitchen. I'm curious to what was the problem? Like, why does there need to be natural deodorant? My wife is a vegetarian and we were in the store the other day and we saw natural sour cream. Mm-hmm. Then we realized, wait a second, that means that the sour cream we've been eating for our whole life is probably not natural.
Yeah.
So I think like a lot of people aren't aware of some of the problems. And so I'd love to speak to that a little bit. So could you tell us like, why is there particularly a need for natural deodorant compared to, mm-hmm. you know, what else out there?
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly, you know, a certain level of greenwashing that happens and, you know, some products that, you know, market themselves as natural, maybe necessarily don't need to be. And, you know, so there's an element of that, you know, and scare tactics was never something that was at the forefront of my marketing. I really just wanted to focus more on why the ingredients I was using were special and important and effective. But, you know, there certainly right. have been studies that have shown that antiperspirants, you know, which use aluminum, they've been linked to things like cancer and Alzheimer's. And then also, you know, beyond the aluminum piece, there's also synthetic ingredients that are used in a lot of deodorants that just, you know, have been, again, potentially linked to certain health issues. And so my whole philosophy has always been, if you have a product that works as well, you know, as these conventional brands, but you know that the ingredients are clean and safe, you know, why wouldn't you choose that latter option?
Right. And you started this back in 2010. In Portland. So I'm from Colorado, mm-hmm. lived there. So I think, you know, Colorado, Oregon, Washington, some of those states, I feel like they're a little bit ahead of the curve as far as adopting more natural products. So I'm sure Portland was wanting those things, but did you notice where, was there a need for this? I guess, there's a need, was there a desire for it or
yeah.
in 2010?
I think Portland was hugely responsible for the early success of my brand because, you know, there were very discerning customers there, people who had embraced, you know, healthier, more natural lifestyle. So I really do think it was the perfect place for me to build this type of company. Also, the community there was just so, you know, artistic and creative and very DIY centered. So people were just excited to support, you know, any creator-born brand in general, right? So being out at farmers markets, there was also a lot of opportunity right. for street festivals and everybody was just making. So, you know, the roots are certainly very, you know, maker, but then, you know, beyond that, just scaling into a, you know, a household name was just never something I imagined coming out of Portland. So it is really fun to look back, you know, at those that early community that was there from day one, keeping me accountable, you know, asking questions about ingredients. Where did you source your baking soda? Right. And like, is this not in GMO? And just, but it was awesome because it, you know, I didn't know everything that went into the ingredients. I was learning as I went. And so having these customers that cared and that challenged me was really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that it's so evident when looking into your products, but also when, you know, when diving into your book, it's just so evident the passion that you put into it. And now that you're on the other side of the business, kind of your passion to help others see that. And what I've loved, I feel like I could just like read your book to our audience and it would be valuable. So in your book, you say in the very first like introduction, you say, I'm living proof that success is possible despite the remarkably high bar that's been set. With the benefit of the know-how that took me 7 years to amass, I'm offering this book as a springboard to super makers. Like, I put it all in these pages from my days hand pouring deodorant in the kitchen to heading up. The book contains not just my own story, but all the lessons I learned along the way. My hope is that it will help you bypass years of toil or self-doubt so you too can embrace and become the super maker you are. You mentioned this phrase in there, springboard for super makers.
Mm.
And I'm curious if, you know, now that you're not as involved with the day-to-day of Schmidt's Naturals, what What kind of started this revelation of really wanting kind of your work to help springboard other super makers and make it bigger than just you and your product you were making?
Oh, I love that question. So I do think my story is a perfect example of, you know, somebody that may not have been positioned for entrepreneurship. You know, I might not, you know, look like the multi-million dollar, you know, company leader. And just, you know, the fact that I had jumped into this business, like, purely based out of just passion and love for what I was doing, right? I think there's so many stories like that, and I want people to understand that they're equipped to make, you know, their business happen and their dreams come true. And I, you know, that's the goal of writing my book, was to not just provide, you know, inspiration through my story, but also provide tools to help people get there. So the book, you know, as you know, is sprinkled with tons of business advice and just really practical tips for growing a consumer products brand.
Yeah. And I mean, it's so evident in there. And in your story, I mean, you majored in business, but kind of reluctantly, kind of because your brother did.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you minored in HR and ended up having employees. You kind of jumped around jobs a little bit for your first, you know, 10 years or so out of college. And it seems like you were just trying different things. How important do you think it is for business owners, for people that, you know, either have a specific desire for business, or, I mean, it doesn't sound like you didn't necessarily have this like, oh my gosh, I want to run a business one day, but it was still really critical for you to just try different things to kind of find your passion. Right. How important do you think it is that we're willing to just try new things and learn new things?
I think if we want to be happy in our work, it's very critical. You know, I never really knew what I wanted to do, but I always knew that I wasn't willing to settle. So I've had a lot of jobs. You know, as you mentioned, I got my degree in business, but I sort of just chose it because I didn't know what else to do. Nothing was really calling me. It seemed like a practical choice that, you know, maybe eventually would come in handy, and it did. But, you know, after college, I had a number of jobs and found my way, you know, working up the corporate ladder pretty quickly and making a great salary with really strong benefits that I, you know, probably could have sustained me for my life. But it just didn't feel like a long-term thing for me. I just knew there was something more, but I had no idea how to articulate that. So I honestly, like, I just decided to, well, I moved out west from Chicago and said, you know what, Portland's a creative town. If any place can help me figure this out, it's Portland. And then I just started getting my hands dirty with a lot of things. And I was terrible at so many things I tried. Like, I tried sewing. I was doing some woodworking for a while. I took some classes in interior design, and just, I either was just really bad at it or I didn't love it. And then I actually had taken a class on how to make shampoo, which is really what kickstarted me making natural personal care products. And I really enjoyed it because, one, I had, you know, sort of a passion and a love for natural things. I was also pregnant at the time, so I was paying closer attention to the products I was using on my skin. So it just all came together nicely. But again, you know, getting out at the market in those early days, it was more just kind of for fun and a way to make a little bit of extra cash on the side until, you know, the business potential became clear.
Right. Yeah, I'm curious to when the moment was that things really shifted to where you realized, like, this could be my future, or the, you know, this could be my career. Like, mm-hmm. this is kind of where it shifted from, you know, a hobby or maybe even a job that was making a little bit of money to where, like, okay, I can, this can grow into a career.
Yeah, it was at those markets and hearing customer testimonials and people really excited about my product, returning every week, asking me what stores they could find my products in. And that's when I realized, you know, I can start selling wholesale. I can build out a real website. And then from there, it all took off.
And when did I've seen that? Okay, so there's kind of that market shift where kind of you realize, okay, the market's there, we can turn this into a business. But then there's also the personal shifts that have to go.
Yeah.
You being a mom making deodorant and products in your kitchen and selling it at farmers markets on the weekends to being a CEO. Like, what was that transition like? And when did you realize in your mind, like, wait a second, I need to figure out how to run a business.
Right. Well, the timing was interesting because I had my son in January of 2010, and I had started some markets the fall before. So I was already kind of out there was already really excited about what I was doing. But, you know, as a new mom, there's obviously a lot of pressures and a lot of tiredness and just, you know, obligations that would be a distraction or, you know, just something to balance with the business. But I embraced all of it. I loved being a new mom. I loved being a new business owner. And it worked out. I would bring my son with me to the markets. I'd bring him into the local stores with me to pitch my product to buyers and just sort of owned all of it at once. And so it's always been, you know, my son has always been a part of the business. I consider him my co-founder now.
Right.
But, you know, as the business scaled, of course, like pressure got a lot heavier and things were a little bit more difficult to manage. And as you mentioned, you know, becoming CEO and, you know, leading a team of 150 employees and just, you know, I was fortunate in that I had a very supportive partner, my husband, Chris. He actually ended up joining the business several years in and we grew it together. And so, you know, it was me, him and our son. And we just, it was kind of a beautiful mixed up, crazy balance of family life and business life that, you know, I wouldn't want any other way.
Yeah. Yeah. I've known, we call my wife my consultant. Because she's not directly involved with the day to day, but yeah, I mean, I think there's just something really special about a partner being able to like provide some insight and, you know, be a part of it and kind of the piece of doing something together, that just feels really, really valuable.
Yeah, especially when you're always like on the verge of like, is this a waste of time? Like, am I crazy? Like, what do I think I am trying to build this business? And so if you have that other, the partner saying, you know, yeah, this is a time suck. And why are you doing this? And, you know, then it's so easy to just let it all flop, right? And just say, all right, I'm done. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious I'm guessing it wasn't all green pastures, you know, from your kitchen to acquisition. So, you know, were there some moments where maybe you considered throwing in the towel or where maybe the pressure you just didn't feel like it was worth it or things weren't working? I'd love to kind of hear, you know, some of the moments where maybe your entrepreneurial journey was the hardest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, throughout the growth of the business, there were, you know, always those moments of doubt and just questioning everything. And it looked a little different as the business grew. I think in the earliest days, the hardest part was getting customer feedback that wasn't favorable. I took it so seriously and it was almost like a, you know, personal attack on me if somebody didn't love my product. And so I would try so hard to make them happy. And there were times even if somebody had a, you know, deodorant stain on their t-shirt, for example, and they had a problem with it, I told them, mail me your shirt and I'll personally clean it for you. And I was doing that. So, you know, really hustling just to keep everyone happy. And that became stressful and unsustainable, you know, and you have to have boundaries and set limits and things. But and then later in the business, it became, you know, big operational challenges that just seemed impossible to overcome. And some of them were impossible to overcome. You know, everyone a day at a time and putting things in perspective and understanding that your customer doesn't always see the big thing challenges that you're up against. You know, it could seem like a huge major problem for you, but on the outside, you know, nobody knows. And so dealing with that internally, you know, it's important just to remind yourself, to put it in perspective and you know, why you're doing what you're doing, right? To keep your customers happy.
Yeah. When did you start taking investment and what was the decision process like? Because I've also seen with like craft makers on that journey of like scaling, I think a lot of makers don't really like it. They think that, you know, if I just sell enough products, then I'll have cash and then I can use that cash to expand. So when was that shift and how did you make that decision to start taking in some outside money to help fuel the growth?
Yeah, I didn't actually raise capital. I bootstrapped the business up to the acquisition by Unilever. So that was,
wow.
That was certainly, you know, added layer of
That's
stress
amazing.
and I guess responsibility for sure. You know, looking back on it, I understand that there were, you know, I had a lot of reasons why it worked out well. You know, the first couple of years, I really sort of eased into the business. It sounds like you're in the early chapters of my book, so you understand. But I, you know, took my time with, you know, really getting the business off the ground. I didn't have big revenue goals set for myself. I, had a small team in the earliest days, so I was really able to take it slowly and just build at my own pace. And in doing that, I also was able to sustain a couple side jobs to help, you know, with the seed money for the business. But then when I committed full time, you know, I didn't have the outside income. And so it really all depended on the success of the business. And a big part of that was our D2C strategy, you know, so building out our website and really depending on those sales, because I was very wholesale heavy in the earliest days of the business. And wholesale was great, but, you know, they're taking a cut of your revenues, you're waiting to get paid. And so that becomes really difficult when you're bootstrapping. And so having, a nice strategy for your website sales is key. And then that money could be recycled back into the business. I did take on a right. business partner. I don't want to ruin the book for you. about 5 years in.
You're fine.
With a small capital contribution, which went towards a labeling machine. But beyond that, we never raised. We got close to doing so in the year that we were acquired by Unilever was the time that I started seeking outside capital because we were really tight for cash. That was the year we had launched in Target, Costco, and Walmart. And so all our money was tied up on store shelves. And, you know, we were a healthy business and we were making a lot of money, but we just didn't have it sitting in the bank.
Help me understand that decision to continue bootstrapping, because again, I'm sure that as you start growing, that everybody's excited to give you their business advice, and I'm sure there are some people that were saying that you should, you know, give up some of your company mm-hmm. and raise some money in different things. So what made you so determined to continue to bootstrap it when, I mean, I feel like over the last 10 years, the entrepreneurship world has been completely obsessed with raising money,
right.
even for a lot of companies that don't need to be raising money or maybe even shouldn't be raising money. So what helped you to really stay true with your desire to just bootstrap it?
Part of it was I was so busy and caught up in the day-to-day operations that I saw it as a distraction. You know, I was hearing from interested investors, but it just was more stressful to me than anything because I thought I don't have time to build a deck. I don't have time to take these calls, these meetings, and I just want to stay focused on the operations. And I had built out in-house manufacturing, so I was, you know, really in it every day, just, you know, walking the warehouse, talking to my team, and just, you know, that in itself, the in-house manufacturing piece is just a huge responsibility.
Right.
And so I just didn't have the time. It was exciting to me, the thought that, you know, there's outside investors who are interested. And but I just, you know, I wanted to maintain control also. I mean, that's, I think, one of the biggest reasons people don't take investment. And I just didn't feel like we really needed it. You know, I loved being at the forefront of the brand. I didn't want any outside opinions. It was going well as it was. I thought, why shake things up if it's working? But in that final year, as mentioned, you know, that's when we really started entertaining those calls. And I can attest to fundraising being a ton of work. I mean, it was
it's a whole other skill, a whole other almost like skill set that people have to learn is how to fundraise.
And, you know, that's, I've become known as kind of, you know, the investor who challenges people's assumptions that they do need outside money, you know, because I'm a big fan of bootstrapping. I think if your business isn't, you know, the type of business that can be built without outside capital, then I always encourage that. But you're right, you know, it's certainly become a trend. It's become kind of the way that brands are built these days. And part of that is because every industry is just so competitive and, you know, people just want to build so quickly because, you know, the next brand is going to come up, you know, in a month or two. And so the competition is just really fierce.
Yeah, I think it's amazing because I would say that like the CPG market is one that people would probably argue, you know, aside from tech, that almost needs outside investment to scale more than anything. So I think it just adds so much value to your story where, you know, you just built by building good product and having a great company. So I think it's amazing. And I'm curious to what some of the obstacles that you see for other makers or other super makers, as you call them in your book, are. So like industry wise, we all know every farmer's market, there's people that have, you know, soaps and products that they're making at their home, they're hoping will scale. What are some of the biggest obstacles that you see makers facing as they want to grow their businesses right now?
Yeah, I think, you know, building up the wholesale piece is very opportunistic and something that I always encourage. You know, I love omni-channel distribution. I think every brand should pursue it. But there's a big cost that comes with that. You know, you're taking major cuts in your costs, or excuse me, in your revenues. You are waiting, you know, 3, sometimes 4 months to get paid by the retailers. And so with a consumer products company, you have, yeah, certainly, you know, challenges that maybe aren't as prevalent in tech. I think I mentioned this before, just the competitive landscape is just so strong across so many industries now. When I started, you know, it was in 2010, there weren't as many homeborn, I guess, CPG companies. I think you're seeing a lot from big CPG, you know, Unilever, P&G, but the number of kind of maker-born brands back then just weren't as common. But now people are seeing success stories and feeling inspired by them and trying to build their own.
Right. Yeah, was investment or was acquisition the goal, or kind of as the business started growing, like what did you see kind of the end goal being for you?
Yeah, I didn't have one. Honestly, I really never looked too far ahead. I just loved what I was doing. I could see that customers were excited, and that was enough to keep me going. And I never thought about an acquisition. In fact, I was, you know, just a bit naive to what that whole scene looked like, right? I didn't, you know, I knew of big CPG. I knew of companies like Unilever and P&G and the opportunities there, but I never considered, you know, me being part of that family. But you know, once those conversations started, I recognized it was, you know, there was serious opportunity, and that, you know, it was a path that actually might make sense for my brand. But I do tell brands today, you know, if you're starting with the goal of being acquired, you know, that can be dangerous. I think it can get in the way of a natural progression for your business. I think you can do it. I've seen companies do it. There was a competing deodorant brand that started around the time I did. You know, their whole goal was to build a company, D2C, and get acquired. And they did it. You know, they actually got acquired shortly before Schmidt's. It was Native deodorant. But the other path, you know, is one like mine that's just born out of kind of a love for what you're doing, not necessarily having an end goal in mind, and then and building very organically that way. So there's two paths, you know. Not everybody has an end goal in mind, and I think that's okay.
Right. Walk me through some of the like what that process was like for the acquisition. Like I'm curious to when you realized that it was possible for, you know, potentially like generational wealth for you and your family as a result of this. And then also like when I'm curious about that moment when you thought it was possible and then when it actually like went through, like when it was a done deal, what that moment was like.
Yeah, it was the process itself was fast, but at the same time just loaded with work, right? There's a lot that went into this. So there's a whole diligence process where you know, you have to dig up a lot of information and kind of background, you know, pieces of your business and present that to the potential acquirer. And that's not easy. I mean, it takes a lot of work to pull up some of these reports. And so there was that piece. There was, you know, in-person meetings. Unilever was flying out from the Netherlands, and you know, their New Jersey offices, and meeting us in Portland and having a few meetings there. And so just the conversations themselves were intense, right? And just, you know, making a case for why my little, you know, deodorant brand that was born in my kitchen deserved to be part of this big family. But it was fun, and learned a lot that I can now help other brands with, you know, today. But you know, when I did see the opportunity, like you mentioned, in terms of just my personal, I guess, wealth opportunity and more chances to be of support to other entrepreneurs and brands, I got real excited, and I, you know, really put my whole self into making it happen. And I understood too that like my story was one that could be of inspiration to other entrepreneurs, and that, you know, after the acquisition, there was a real opportunity for me to do things that could help the next generation of consumer brands.
When was it like finalized, like were you in a meeting or were you somewhere else when like did you get any like I know a famous story in the entrepreneur world is like the Twitch guys and how you know they were all at a wedding when the money like hit their bank account and then they realized like holy crap this is actually real like our life will forever be different like where were you and what were the emotions like once that process was actually finalized?
Yeah, we closed our deal on New Year's Eve, 2017. And it was certainly very surreal, you know, checking the bank account multiple times to make sure I was seeing it correctly and that, you know, the money was still there, and kind of just worried,
right.
like, how, you know, I don't, this is just such a new thing for me. I grew up in a Midwestern family, very, you know, frugal, and just had the basics. And so being presented with this new opportunity of wealth for me was confusing and a little scary, to be frank. And, but again, I knew that it offered me opportunity to be of support to others and really, you know, be responsible with the money. And so one of the first things I did was hire an investment, or excuse me, a financial advisor. That in itself was a whole process that was kind of weird and annoying, you know, interviewing people to find the right one that made sense to manage your money. And so that was the first step, really, was just, you know, getting it under control and understanding
right.
what do we do now?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I want to transition to kind of your work with Color Capital and what you're doing now. And also anybody in the audience that's listening, if you have questions, go ahead and hit the, you know, plus sign to come on stage to speak. We'd love to start taking some questions. But how has your perspective shifted kind of post-acquisition? And, you know, it seems like you're wanting to support other makers and different things. Mm-hmm. But like how after the acquisition from CEO to now investor?
It's really cool to be in a position where I can invest with operator experience. You know, a lot of investors out there have capital and, you know, they're great at allocating it. But, you know, for me, I bring an added advantage of having, you know, been through growing a business. And so that's something that, you know, I'm excited about. And I think with the right brands, I can really help kind of take them to the next level. And so I didn't understand right at the time of the acquisition that I wanted to be an investor. But once I started hearing from companies looking for support, I realized, you know, that would be an exciting opportunity for me. And there's so many just amazing
right.
brands coming up that I'm just so happy to be a part of, right? And without the stresses of growing it myself.
Yeah.
And so just inserting capital and, you know, my expertise and helping how I can.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, it's awesome to see. I mean, it's kind of the dream, you know, being able to success doing something that you love and then being able to use that success to help serve others. So anybody that has a question about, you know, whether it's acquisition focused or building Schmidt's Naturals, anything, feel free to come on stage and we'll give you an opportunity to ask Jamie your question. What kind of companies, like, do you have a specific demographic of companies that you're looking for or looking to invest with Color Capital?
Yeah, I'm excited about consumer brands. You know, that's where my expertise is. And we usually invest at seed stage up to Series A. We've done a few pre-seeds. We've actually done a Series B too. So a bit flexible there. But our check sizes generally range between 50 and 250,000, you know, depending where we plug in. But we love companies that are, you know, doing things a bit differently in stale industries. You know, I think Schmidt's is a great example of the type of company that I would love to invest in. You know, the deodorant industry is not necessarily a sexy one, but, you know, I took an approach that that the competitors weren't considering, right? I had decided to take Naturals to the mainstream and pursue distribution channels that were otherwise overlooked. And so I look for that
right.
in other industries too.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious to what the main areas of support that you like wish that you had, like, now looking back on your journey while you were building Schmidt's, mm. you know, before the acquisition, now you're kind of in the opportunity to provide the support that probably you needed. So what are those areas where you wish you had support, whether it was resources or mentorship, or mm-hmm. what are those areas of support that you wish you had?
I think the distribution piece was such a time suck, and trying to understand the right way to approach that and the strategy there. And I think I handled it well. And I think, you know, I guess you could consider the way I, you know, built Schmidt's across different retail channels a success. But I think having some insights there would have been really helpful. And I think that's really where I add value, is helping founders understand opportunity with new channels of distribution for their product. I think the marketing piece, you know, I was fortunate. I had my husband, Chris, he was heading up our marketing, but not every company has that. And I think there's big opportunity to support there. And then just, you know, the getting people prepared for the possibility of acquisition. You know, there, I learned everything that goes into the diligence and those conversations, and, you know, ways that you can prepare your brand for that possibility. And so I think offering that support has been really advantageous for some of the brands I work with too.
Yeah. What were some of those, the like unexpected things that when you guys were going through due diligence, you're preparing for the acquisition that you didn't even, I mean, you mentioned kind of like, you know, obviously having thorough financial statements. Mm-hmm. I think that most people think, okay, yeah, you're going to have your finances in order. What were some other things that you did not expect would be that you guys would have to put time or resources into, like getting an order for that acquisition?
There were things like partnerships that got a little problematic. So, for example, if we had signed an agreement that had maybe non-compete clauses in there, or we had, you know, really long terms on our agreements, like a 3-year contract, for example, like those became problematic because Unilever wasn't necessarily interested in taking those on. So that's when, yeah, I always encourage founders, you know, negotiate all the contracts or all the terms of your contracts to have, you know, the minimal amount of exclusivity and the minimal amount of or length of terms of your agreement too. And that everything is negotiable there. And I think sometimes as founders, we get busy or we just don't want to deal with the negotiations, but it's worth it, I think, later, because later that just can become a problem. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you over the last 10 years, have you been a fan of Shark Tank or kind of some of more of the shows that show the investment side?
Yeah, I love those shows. I actually want to be a guest judge on there. I think it'd be so fun.
I mean, what do you see, like, because there's so many maker brands, there's so many people that come on that have like made a product or some kind of like mm-hmm. spinoff of a product. I'm curious to what you see on when you're watching Shark Tank of like what do you like and what do you not like, what you see there.
Yeah, there's some great business ideas that I definitely get excited about, but then there's some where you just know the customer community just might be too small to scale, which, you know, is okay for the founder, but in terms of from the investor standpoint, you know, probably might not be the right company to invest in. But it's fun to watch. I think, you know, a lot of that is certainly scripted and, you know, made for TV. But I get excited about seeing, you know, the financials on there and hearing people's pitches, and just, I'm actually really impressed because I think about, you know, me in my earliest days going on TV and trying to convince people to invest in my company. I don't know if I would have done well. So it's fun to watch, and just like, I'm blown away by some of the founders that are on there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. And I think there's some perspective that people have kind of developed after watching so much Shark Tank where we, you know, we think, okay, cool. I have a product. I'm going to go and, you know, give away half my company and raise money and be successful. And I think it's kind of oversimplified it, but I think people realizing like your dream is possible, like you can do this. I think it's so valuable for people to understand, like you can make a product, build a company, you know, have a lifestyle company that funds your lifestyle, or you can sell it. Like just people realizing that opportunity is real mm-hmm. is something that, I think that other generations, they didn't really like see, they didn't have that that inspiration all around them. So I think it's amazing, you know, that we can see that now, that we can see it's possible.
Yeah, I think from a viewer standpoint, that it's super really cool because, you know, there's young kids sitting at home watching the show and thinking, wow, like someday I might have my business idea, and, you know, maybe I can create a brand out of, you know, something that I love. And so I definitely agree with you there. I actually had started to fill out the application for it a couple of years into the business because everybody kept saying, you should be on Shark Tank. And I remember, but then I got like busy and distracted. I was like, I can't deal with this right now. So it fell to the wayside like a lot of things. But there was a deodorant brand on
it. Well, I mean, it worked.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And I'm so inspired by your story of how like, I mean, you pretty much just kept doing the work and kept focusing on doing a really good job. I'm curious, were there ever moments where, not necessarily you guys like thought about compromising your product or anything, but I'm sure as you scaled, it got harder to maintain the levels of quality that were, you know, a little bit easier in your kitchen.
Yeah.
What were some of those challenges? Yeah. Talk it, help me understand kind of like that challenge as you grow it and like maintaining the natural, like pretty much maintaining your product values as you continue to grow.
I think for me personally, one of the biggest challenges was just being able to let go of the manufacturing and put it into somebody else's hands. I did say I built up manufacturing in-house. So I was able to stay close to the product, but I wasn't the one on the assembly line, you know, pouring the deodorant. So that felt strange to me. But one way I stayed really close to the product was, you know, anytime we added a new formula or a new fragrance, I personally was the one creating that, and I would do it in my home kitchen. So even though I had this like 30,000 square foot factory, I would spend, you know, time in my little kitchen at home creating new fragrances. And so that was one way that I felt I could stay very connected to the creative process and just, you know, the quality control. Right. But as we got bigger, we also took on a contract manufacturer. So we were using an outside factory to help produce because we just couldn't keep up with demand. And it just was a smart thing to do, right, to have a backup. And so that, you know, that took a lot of oversight. I, you know, would travel out to the factory and sit with them and just make sure that the product was, you know, being made to my specs. We would sit there and cut the deodorant sticks in half and really analyze, you know, every quality of the product. And it's hard. It's hard when, especially when it is a product that's born out of just a love for making, you know, to be able to scale it and sort of let go. But I think one of the biggest challenges that came up later was we had an opportunity to sell in China, for example. And, you know, there was a distributor there that was willing to buy a lot of product. And my business partner at the time was pushing it and really wanted to do it. But I just was refusing because they require animal testing. And that was just one thing that I was never willing to do for my product. And so that's just an example of, you know, when your values are at stake, you know, and making that tough decision between, you know, making more revenues, but standing by, you know, the principles that your business was built on. And so that's hard as you get bigger. You have to make those choices about what's important to you.
Right. What were some of those values for you that really like guided you along the way of building your business?
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, from day one, we're vegan and cruelty free, and our customers love that about us. And as, you know, as you get bigger, not everybody cares about those things, but that to me was at the core of who we were as a brand. And so that was always at the forefront of every decision that I made. Which became a challenge because I also had the goal of making my product available to as many people as possible, you know, selling internationally, selling across retail channels that, like, as I mentioned, other natural brands were overlooking. But at the same time, you know, having to say no to things that I just weren't a good fit.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's so, again, it's inspirational and amazing that you guys continue to stay with those values throughout the way. Was pricing a challenge for you? Because I've noticed, like, I think I've initially came to the realization that we should probably be spending more money on things. Like, we've almost been, whether it's food or products we put on our body or whatnot, realizing that we've kind of been tricked into thinking that, you know, we can live off of a very little amount of groceries, but reality is it's really crappy food that's toxic for our body. So I think that's one thing, like, people often, they want to go natural. They want to use natural products, but they're like, oh, it's too expensive. How was, like, overcoming some of those objections? And or I imagine early on, you probably had to realize, like, you know, we probably can't charge the same amount as your mass-produced aluminum-filled deodorants. And how was that for you when you're wanting to, you know, wash the stains out of your cut?
Right. Well, the good thing about, you know, personal care products and cosmetics is generally the margins are pretty good, you know, so I had a lot of wiggle room there. But, you know, as you start selling in wholesale and have other expenses, those margins get, you know, start getting cut into. So it does become a challenge. And especially when, you know, wanting my product to be available to the masses, I couldn't price it at the price points that you might see in, you know, Sephora. And so there were strategic ways around it, you know, without compromising on quality. And one example is when I sold into Target, you know, they said, there's no way we're going to price your deodorant at the $11 price point we're seeing at Whole Foods. So we were able to come up with a smaller size deodorant stick, you know, that was able to bring our costs down, meet the price point that they wanted. And so it's challenging, but I think there are ways that brands can do it, you know, whether it's through smaller sizes like that, or through exclusive product offerings. And but just, you know, always knowing where you're not willing to be flexible and compromise on ingredient quality.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love hearing how entrepreneurs solve those problems and that you don't have to compromise. I think a lot of people think like, oh, you're going to have to compromise along some of the way. You're going to have to give up some of your company. You're going to have to like all of these things they just think is inevitable. But it's not like you can make it work. And I think your story is such a testament to that. As we kind of bring this to a close, Jamie, what are you excited about for kind of the season, for these next 10 years of your life? More sitting in the investor seat, like I imagine that there's just been a big shift in your mindset and in your mind, mm-hmm. as you know, kind of post acquisition. So what are you looking forward to, and what are you excited for this next of your life?
I get excited every day just opening my email and seeing pitches from brands. I just think there's so many cool founders doing incredible things, and I think that's just awesome for the economy and just, you know, as an investor. So that's exciting to me. I have some other projects in the works. I'll be on a show on Entrepreneur Media that we're filming next month in Miami. It's called Going Public, and it follows five founders on their fundraising journey. And most of them end up going public or raising through Regulation A+. So I'll be a mentor in there, which is all new for me. I've never been on a TV series before, so this will be fun. And then beyond that, there's some other media projects in the works. So just, you know, everything I do, I just want, my goal is really to empower the next generation of entrepreneurs. I love maker and creator born brands, and anything I can do to help, you know, amplify their stories and help lead them on the path to success is exciting to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, thank you so much for sharing your story. I think it's inspirational. And even just beyond that, I think that it's so important that people hear from your story, that you don't have to make these compromises along the way, that you can build a business, you can hold to your values, you can build it your way. And if anybody has not gotten your book in the audience, it's called Supermaker. It's amazing. You need to get it. And it's fun. It's like a fun, just the way that it's written. It's a fun book to read. Last question. I'm curious what was the last thing that are you still cooking up some things and experimenting with some things in your kitchen, just for fun? 'Cause that's, you know, what you enjoy doing.
Probably more food focused now than personal care. I remember when COVID first hit and everybody's, you know, started DIYing everything. I thought I'm getting back to like my roots of making lotions and soaps and things. And I did it, but I lost my, like, my edge. Like, I'm not as good at it, or I don't have as much patience. And I realize there's other things I want to spend my time on. But I do love making, and I'm always looking for more ways to express my creative self. But I think it's become more focused on food, and I'm letting the Schmitz Naturals team kind of lead on the personal care stuff.
Yeah. Are there some other products that you have in the back of your mind that you might launch one day, or do you think you'll kind of stay in the investor seat?
Yeah, I'm asked that a lot, you know, if I would ever start another brand, and I almost feel like I know too much. Like, I really believe that being, you know, a bit naive and new to the game was an asset for me in growing my brand. And so coming in now would look a lot different for me. So I think I'll keep my efforts focused on, you know, investing and more stuff around publications like my book and some other media opportunities.
Yeah. Well, Jamie, thank you so much for sharing your story, for coming on the Small Business Storytellers. It's been a pleasure to have you here. And anybody listening to this, go and check out the book Supermaker, and also check what the team is doing at color.capital. Any last kind of words of encouragement to listeners or to other makers out there? Go, Jamie.
Yeah, you know, the title of my book is Supermaker, Crafting Business on Your Own Terms. And the own terms piece is just, I think, so important in growing your brand. Like, there's a lot of advice out there. There are a lot of, you know, brands that serve as inspiration, but it's really all about, you know, your own path and your own journey, what you think is best for you and your company. And so just try to block out the noise and grow at your own pace. You know, there's so much hustle now with, like, let's start a company and grow it as fast as we can, and that can be sustainable for a lot of people, but for some it's not. And so if that's not your jam, then you know, grow at your own pace and craft business on your own terms.
Yeah, I love it. Well, Thank you, Jamie. Best of luck to you in your ventures over at Color Capital. And yeah, thank you for the story and for sticking to your values and being a good example to all of us.
Yes, thank you, Seth. I love this app, and I saw Fallon in the audience, so thanks for making this possible.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we'll talk to you then.
All right, take care.
Thank you so much for listening to the Small Business Storytellers. If you've wanted to start a podcast and have been wondering if you can use podcasting to grow your business, but don't know where to start, I'd love to talk. Head to successwithstories.com/podcast to learn exactly how to launch, grow, and profit from a podcast for your business. Again, that is successwithstories.com/podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And if you like this episode, share it with someone you know who would also like it. If you want to be a guest on the podcast or know someone who would be a great guest on the show, let me know. Thank you, and we will see you next time on the Small Business Storytellers.